come to a new section this afternoon, Romans 4 on page 3, the relation of archaeology to Bible history. I've inserted this section between our discussion of Genesis 11 and our discussion of Genesis 12 and following, because when you get to Genesis 12 with Abraham, you are in the period of time in which archaeology has a bearing on the biblical material. Prior to the time of Abraham, you're really in that period where there isn't extra-biblical historical data that relates to the biblical data. So I think at this point it's good to reflect a bit on archaeology and some of its methods and its benefits and uses. You're reading Dr. McCrae's book, and in fact, on this Roman 4, capital A is a general survey of biblical archaeology, its history and methods. I'm not going to do that in class lecture. I'm leaving that for your reading of McCrae's booklet to fill in, at least in a brief way, a resume of the history and methods of archaeological research. But what I do want to treat is B, the role of archaeology in assessing the historical statements of the Bible. Because I think that's important. That deals with methodology. How do we use archaeology? What's its function in relation to our biblical study? Certainly archaeology, so I'll begin there with B, the role of archaeology in assessing the historical statements of the Bible. Certainly archaeology has done a great deal to increase our understanding of the Bible. I don't think there's any question about that. We know a lot more about biblical times today than we did, say, 100 years ago because of the results of archaeological research. But I think it's important to put the role of archaeological research in biblical study into a proper perspective. And what I mean by that is, what is it that archaeology can and cannot do? I think sometimes too much importance has been given to archaeology. It is important. I don't want to minimize that. But sometimes too much importance has been given to archaeology, and that's done from two different perspectives, quite radically different perspectives. You will find that often critical scholars who don't have a view of historical trustworthiness of Scripture, they will use archaeology to suggest that statements in the biblical text that are not confirmed by archaeological findings are suspect. And in some cases, it is said that archaeological findings have proved that the Bible is inaccurate and that what's recorded there didn't happen. Now, that's on one side of the coin, you might say, from critical approach, where they either consider statements suspect or say that they're inaccurate historically because of the findings of archaeological research. On the other hand, you have conservative scholars who have utilized archaeological research as proof of the Bible's accuracy. And there's, you know, a lot of handbooks that speak about the way archaeology has proved the Bible to be true. In some instances, I think the archaeological evidence has corroborated and substantiated biblical statements. But there are also cases where conservative scholars have said, here's archaeology showing us that the Bible is true, when it's turned out later that the particular interpretation of the archaeological data that's being used has been modified or changed, and that the use to which it was being put then no longer really holds because the interpretation of the data was something that maybe was questionable, and later with more evidence or reinterpretation has been revised. So I think it's important that we don't elevate archaeological research to a position where its, quote, scientific results rule over the Scripture in an unwarranted way in the interpretation of Scripture. Archaeological findings do not always provide the last word on questions of historical interpretation. I think there's a misconception there. It's often, well, did this really happen or not? Let's go to the archaeologist. Let's let the archaeologist tell us. It's important to realize that in many cases, not in every case, but in many cases, archaeologists do not speak with unanimity in their own conclusions. In other words, one archaeologist is going to say, with respect to the interpretation of certain findings, that this is what it means. Another archaeologist is going to say something else. And there's not unanimity on many, many cases of interpretation of data by archaeologists. So it's not as if, in some unified way, archaeology tells us something. It's more complex than that. And that being the case, I think we need to develop an understanding of how archaeology can function as an aid in biblical studies and interpretation, which it really can be. But we need to understand how it can do that without either expecting too much from it on the one hand or minimizing its importance on the other hand. You can go both directions with it. So what you need is a critical, balanced kind of understanding of how archaeological data can function in biblical interpretation. We need to have discernment. We have to have carefulness in drawing conclusions from archaeological findings as that relates to Scripture. Now, in view of that, I want to call your attention to two things that are listed as 1 and 2 under B on your outline sheet. I think there are two principles here that go a long way in helping us to get the correct perspective. And I think these are very important. One is archaeological evidence is of necessity very fragmentary in nature. Just by the character of what it is, it's never going to be complete. It's very fragmentary. And secondly, the interpretation of archaeological evidence is in many cases only tentative. So let's look at those two things. First, archaeological evidence is of necessity very fragmentary in nature. Just because of the nature of the discipline itself, we can be certain that we will only have available a fraction of the evidence that we might desire to have at our disposal on any given question, as far as archaeological evidence is concerned. And that principle is important because of what I mentioned earlier. There are those who will conclude that a biblical statement is suspect if it doesn't have archaeological confirmation. Now, if the nature inherently is fragmentary, we shouldn't expect confirmation of everything. And therefore, the idea that something's suspect because we don't have it is invalid. Now, on your bibliography, page 12. The first three entries are some articles and books of Edwin Yamauchi, who is a professor of history at Miami University in Ohio, and an evangelical historian, very much interested in archaeology of the ancient Near East. In his article, The Stone Scripts and Scholars, as well as in chapter 4 of the next book, The Stones and the Scriptures, and in the article, Archaeological Confirmation of Suspect Elements in the Classical and Biblical Traditions, he develops a line of reasoning that I want to use here in our own discussion. And that's basically this, on the fragmentary nature of archaeological evidence. He points out the following things. First, only a fraction of what is made or what is written ever survives. Only a fraction of what is made or what is written ever survives. Now that can be illustrated in a lot of ways. Perishable materials, such as papyri, which was used in the ancient world to write on, in many instances, is simply disintegrated and disappeared. It's is not durable. Stone inscriptions, in many cases, have not survived. It's reasonable to expect that the kings of Israel and Judah erected stone stelae with inscriptions on them, similar to the kings of Moab. We have the Moabite stone. I'm not sure if you've read about that, Finnegan, yet or not, but King Mesha of Moab had a stone inscription on it, which was found, and we have copies of that. It's the stones in the Louvre in Paris. But it's reasonable to expect that Israelite kings made similar inscriptions, but none of them have been found. If they did, they either haven't yet been discovered or they've been destroyed, disappeared through time. There's only one fragment of an Israelite stele containing a single word, just a small piece with one word, that's ever been found. There were hundreds of synagogues in Palestine in the New Testament era. Only one synagogue from before 70 AD has been discovered, one in Capernaum. The rest, which were certain, there were many of them, have not been discovered. Now, there are a lot of illustrations of that sort of thing, but only a fraction of what is made or what is written survives. Part of the reason with buildings, like, say, synagogues, why you don't find the remains of them is that it was common practice for people in the ancient world to take the materials from an old building and use it to build another building, so that the source of building material comes from previous buildings, and they're just picked up and removed and put somewhere else, and there's no trace then left of what of the original building. And then you have all the natural forces of erosion, decay, all that sort of thing that do their work as well. So only a fraction of what is made or written survives. Secondly, only a fraction of the available sites in Canaan or the Holy Land have ever been surveyed. By surveyed, that means identify these sites. In 1944, the Palestine Gazette listed a total of about 3,000 sites in the area west of the Jordan and several hundred in Transjordan. So in 44, there are about 3,000 identified archaeological sites. In 1963, the total of known sites had increased to about 5,000. Largely because of surveys of Nelson Gluck. I think you read about him and McRae. That was 63. In 66 and 67, there were some surveys done in the Negev, that's in the south, that turned up about 200 new sites. And then in 67, 68, there were surveys in the Golan Heights after the capture of that territory. And some additional sites were found there. Moshe Kakavi, director of that survey, said our survey of Judea surveyed about 1,200 sites, of which some 20 to 30% are new sites, previously unrecorded. I estimate that not more than one-third of the amount of possible sites were recorded, and a thorough survey is a question of many years, including the yet unsurveyed parts of pre-war Israel. So that you see, there's an enormous number of sites, certainly 3,000 plus, of identified archaeological sites in Palestine. C, or 3, is only a fraction of the surveyed sites have been excavated. In 1963, Paul Lapp estimated that of 5,000 sites in Palestine, there had been scientific excavations at about 150 sites. And see, there's where you start getting into the numbers. And you can easily have the idea there's an enormous amount of archaeological work being done, and there is. But compared to the potential, it's only a small fraction. You see, 5,000 sites, 150 sites have been excavated, And of the 150, only 26 are major excavations, where they've really done a thorough job. And even in those cases, it's not 100% thorough. But in other words, major excavations, only 26. Now, Lapp says, to be sure, many of the sites on record would not merit extensive excavation. But if only one in four were promising, major excavations have till now been carried out on only 2% of the potential sites. So it's you're working down only a fraction of what is made or written survives, a fraction of available sites have been surveyed, and then only a fraction of the surveyed sites, and it's a small fraction, have ever been excavated. So we go on to four. With few exceptions, only a fraction of any excavated site has actually been examined. There are exceptions to that, of course. You have the small, short-lived kinds of sites like the Qumran community, which is in a relatively small area and was not inhabited for a long period of time, and that's been completely excavated. And you have the site of Masada there on the west of the Dead Sea, where the Jews sort of held out against the Romans. It was short-lived and small, and that's been pretty well completely excavated. But for the most part, when you excavate a site, you don't completely excavate the entire site. So with few exceptions, only a fraction of any excavated site's actually been examined. Now, some of the exceptions to that, besides the short-lived small sites, are Megiddo, for example, which in the years between 1925 and 34 was excavated by the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago. And the idea of that excavation, which is a major excavation, was to take the site of Megiddo, which is a fairly good-sized site, and just completely work down through, layer by layer, the entire mound, the entire site. They were successful in removing the top four strata of the mound. But that was eventually abandoned. That's an enormous undertaking to do something like that. And something on that scale hasn't been attempted since. But that means that any excavation is almost bound to miss important finds, because what they'll do is select a section where they think, well, maybe there was the gate to the city here, an important building here, and they'll go in at that place. They may be right, they may be wrong. And they're bound to miss things. And Yamauchi points out in his article that even in an extensive excavation like Megiddo, it's embarrassing to report that a cuneiform text of the Gilgamesh epic was found by shepherds in the discarded debris from the excavations of Megiddo. It's rather amazing, because things like that are done with care. But you see, the point is, if you get a clay tablet with some cuneiform markings on it, and it's buried in the mud, very difficult to tell that clay tablet just from a piece of dirt or a stone. And probably what happened there was they were digging the stuff out, it was missed, it was on a pile, and then rain came and washed some of the mud off, the dirt off, and then you could see what it was. But in any case, a very important text, even in a carefully excavated site, was missed. It was found in the debris. So it's that kind of situation. John Garstang, who excavated a number of places in Palestine, concluded from his work at Hatzor in 1928 that the site was not an important city in the 14th and 13th centuries BC because he did not find any Mycenaean pottery, a certain type of pottery. And if it had been occupied 14th, 13th centuries BC, there should have been Mycenaean pottery there. The book of Joshua says that when the Israelites came in under Joshua's leadership and went to the north, they fought at Hazor and destroyed the city. And it was the major city in the north and was occupied. Well, Garstang didn't find the Mycenaean pottery, and he says it's not an important city at that time because he didn't find that there. Well, in more recent times, the site has been re-excavated or excavated further, and Yadin, the Israeli archaeologist, has found floors littered with Mycenaean pottery. So you see, in drawing the conclusion the first time because he didn't find something was really invalid, because later it was found that the very thing he hadn't found was nevertheless there. And Yadin found a lot of Mycenaean pottery. Now, Hazor is a comparatively large site for Canaanite sites. There's an upper city and a lower city. The upper city is about 30 acres, and the lower city about 175 acres. So you're talking of a site of about 200 acres, which, as far as cities go, today is not a very big city. But if you want to excavate something like that, that's a big job. Yadin worked with more than 30 archaeologists. He had a large staff and a whole crew of 100 or more laborers. He managed to clear 1/400th of the site in four seasons. That is 1/1600th per season from 1955 to 58. And he suggested it would take 800 years of about 4 or 5 months' work. Work's usually done in the summer. And he said it would take 800 years of 4 or 5 months' work a year, although he only was working 3 months a year, to clear the entire site. So obviously, that's not going to be done, or it's highly unlikely that that'll ever be done. But just project that kind of problem onto larger sites. If you go to Babylon, that covers 2,500 acres instead of 200. Nineveh covers 1,850 acres. So at Yadin's estimated rate of progress for Hazor, it'd take about 8,000 years to excavate Babylon in a complete way. Yeah. All right. Five. Only a fraction of the materials, and especially the inscriptions produced by the excavations, has been published. Because of the scarcity of people who have the training to decipher these languages and translate these languages and publish the texts that are written in cuneiform and a variety of different scripts and languages, there is a great time lag between the discovery of the texts and their publication. A Babylonian king list acquired in the 1880s by the British Museum was published in 1954. So you go from 1880 to 1954, it was about 75 years time lag between when the thing was actually dug up and when it was published. The Lippitt-Ishtar Law Code, if you read about that in Finnegan, I don't know if you recall that, but it was excavated by the University of Pennsylvania in the late 1800s, and it lay on the shelves at the University Museum in Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania Museum, until Francis R. Steele recognized the significance of this tablet in 1947 and published this law code. And Francis R. Steele happens to be an evangelical scholar at that time. He's still a scholar, but he was a curator or assistant curator at the University Museum in the 50s. He subsequently has left that and for many years was director of the North African Mission, and I think recently retired. But he published, translated, Lepidishtar Code. But it had been in the museum there for 60, 70 years before he came on it. The present curator of Akkadian language at the University of Pennsylvania Museum says, with few exceptions, Western museums have still not caught up with the flow of antiquities, and their basements and storerooms are full of undiscovered treasures. In the field of Assyriology, of course, we rely almost entirely on existing collections of cuneiform tablets rather than on new excavations. We have absorbed such a small percentage of the hundreds of thousands of tablets in museums that new discoveries are almost routine. In a tablet collection the size of the one at the University Museum, every drawer holds a surprise. The only problem we have is which drawer to open. In other words, there's such a backlog of material that because of the lack of funding and expertise of people to work with that material, that there's just an enormous amount of it that hasn't been looked at, even though it's been excavated. Samuel Kramer, who was professor of Sumeriology at the University of Pennsylvania, estimates that about 10% of the approximately 500,000 cuneiform texts that have been excavated have ever been published. So that's probably a good guess. About 10% of the material that's been excavated has ever been published. At Mari, city in Mesopotamia, near Babylon, 25,000 texts were discovered, 2,800 have been published. Of the tablets found at Eshnunna between 1930 and 1936, most of them have not been published. The laws of Eshnunna have been published, but most of the texts have not. Leonard Woolley excavated at Ur of the Chaldees, Mesopotamia, in the 1930s, and publication's not complete, still going on. So we have to remember that only a fraction of the materials, and especially the inscriptions, produced by excavations have been published. Yamauchi diagrams the situation in this way. He speaks in what he calls circles of evidence. And he divides it into three circles of evidence. You have the biblical text, or you would have the literary material. If you're not talking about the biblical text, you could be talking about other classical literary texts. Then you have literary remains and material remains. Archaeological findings are basically of two types. Material remains, that is buildings, monuments, pottery, statues, things of that sort. Literary remains would be writings on various kinds of materials. Legal documents, letters, court animals, panels, poems, all sorts of types of literary remains. Now, if you plot the biblical record in one circle, possible combinations. You can have material which is, for the most part, what you will find in the biblical text that is not touched by either literary or material remains. And you can have material remains or literary remains that have no corroboration from one of the other circles of evidence. Then you can have an overlap between material remains and the biblical text, some reference to a wall, a city, or whatever. And you find it in material remains, you find it in the biblical text. And the same with literary remains. You can find some sort of extra-biblical written thing that corroborates something that's in the biblical text, perhaps from an Assyrian king. It says he took tribute from an Israelite king. And the biblical text says the same thing. Where you will find both literary and material and the biblical text is a relatively small section where all three overlap. Now, those aren't drawn with the idea of any kind of exact percentages, but I think the concept is important. And particularly, I think it's important that you don't expect an overlap with the majority of the material because of the nature of the evidence that you're dealing with. So to get back where we began with this point, by the nature of the discipline itself, we will only have available a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of potential available evidence that we might wish to have. Now, with that in mind, certainly it is not a valid procedure to assume that a biblical statement is suspect if it doesn't find corroboration in archaeological findings. We shouldn't expect corroboration for everything. In fact, we shouldn't expect corroboration for most. An example of this sort of thing, which is very frequently referred to, is that in the book of Daniel, you have reference to Darius the Mede. There's no extra-biblical corroboration of Darius the Mede. And the conclusion of many critical scholars is that whoever wrote the book of Daniel didn't know his history and that it's inaccurate, and Darius the Mede never existed. Now, exactly who Darius the Mede was, there have been several suggestions. Some think it's another name for Cyrus. Some think it was a governor that Cyrus appointed. There are various proposals for that. But you see, the principle involved is just because we don't have extra-biblical corroboration for the existence of Darius the Mede is no reason to conclude that Darius the Mede did not exist. Yamauchi points out that if we had to depend on inscriptional evidence to prove the historicity of Pontius Pilate, we would have had to wait until 1961 when the first epigraphical documentation concerning him was discovered at Caesarea. So that we can't jump to the conclusion that without the corroboration that the biblical statement is suspect. The first epigraphical attestation of Herod the Great was discovered in 1963 to 65. Okay, any questions on... One, archaeological evidence is of necessity very fragmentary in nature. You see the implications of that. Secondly, the interpretation of archaeological evidence is in many cases only tentative. Now, I think that's another important principle because it's often the case that interpretation of archaeological evidence is subject to revision or reinterpretation in the light of additional evidence. That means interpretation of archaeological evidence is something you have to be very careful about. It's an area where caution is extremely important. And I think that has application in the area both with respect to what certain critics have claimed shows the Bible to be inaccurate or historically unreliable from archaeological evidence, as well as those things which conservative scholars have used to say that this proves the accuracy of Scripture. I think the thing to keep in mind is that different types of archaeological evidence have to be read with different degrees of certainty concerning their interpretation. There's different types of evidence. And interpretations of the evidence, depending on the type of evidence, may range from doubtful to possible to probable to certain, a whole spectrum, depending on the nature of the evidence. Now, some things can be quite clear. You can get a written statement that leaves very little to interpretation. It's quite clear what it says. and then you have something that's quite firm. But you can unearth something, some kind of building or structure, and not be very certain as to what it is. There's no written, nothing there, nothing written. You don't know exactly what the date of it is. You don't know exactly who built it. You don't exactly know what the purpose of the thing was. You have to be careful about how you interpret that kind of material. Now, to illustrate that, in 1 Kings 9, 15 and 19, you read, here is the account of the forced labor, 1 Kings 9:15. King Solomon conscripted to build the Lord's temple, his own palace, the supporting terraces, the wall of Jerusalem, and Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. In verse 19, you read, he built these various places, and then as well as all his store cities and the towns for his chariots and his horses, whatever he desired to build in Jerusalem and Lebanon and throughout all the territory he ruled. Over in chapter 10, verse 26, you read, Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horses, which he kept in the chariot cities and also with him in Jerusalem. The king made silver common in Jerusalem as stones. Cedar is plentiful of sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Kuwait. The royal merchants purchased them from Kuwait. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. They exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the Arameans. Now, what we find from those texts is that Solomon traded in horses and chariots. Seems to have been a middleman in that trade. And he built up his own military establishment of chariots and horses. And Megiddo was one of his important building sites. You read that in 9:15. Megiddo is also, as we've already noticed, one of those sites that's been rather carefully excavated by the University of Chicago Oriental Institute. Those excavations began in 1925 with the idea being to work down through the entire mound, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. And what they found was that in the first layer, there were ruins from the time of the Persian and Babylonian empires. That's on the top, about the 6th century BC. The second layer had evidence of Assyrian rule, which would be about the 8th century. And then layers 3 and 4 were the Israelite period prior to Assyrian domination of the Northern Kingdom. After a number of years of digging, they came to what they concluded was the time of Solomon in that Israelite period. And in that layer, they found the remains of some rather strange buildings, the unique feature of which was rows of stone pillars. You've probably seen pictures of this in any handbook on Bible archaeology. These rows of stone pillars with holes in them near the top of the pillar. And the director of the excavation came to the conclusion that the buildings were stables and that the pillars were hitching posts for the horses, which at the same time served as roof supports. And the holes were holes through which the horses could be tied to those pillars. And at the same time, they served as roof supports. Now, that's often referred to as Solomon's Stables at Megiddo. You'll find it in almost any archaeological handbook. It was said to corroborate Solomon's chariot cities, 1 Kings 9:19. Solomon's trade in chariots and horses, 1 Kings 10:26 to 29. And Solomon's building operation at Megiddo, 1 Kings 9:15. Now the interesting thing is that today the whole thesis is under question because of reinterpretation of the evidence in question. In 1970, James Pritchard wrote an article. I believe that's on your sheet. Two-thirds of the way or three-quarters of the way down page 11. The Megiddo Stables, a reassessment in Near Eastern archaeology in the 20th century. He, among other people, have reviewed the evidence and have abandoned the previous conclusion on the basis of further study and more complete evidence. And the reason for the change was a number of things, the first of which was the dating of the level in question. For various reasons, and that gets technical, Pritchard and others felt that the level in question belonged to the time of Ahab, not to the time of Solomon. So you're not even talking about the time of Solomon. You see, you're getting into this area of interpretation of evidence. It's difficult. And then in addition, Pritchard proposed that the buildings were not stables. On the basis of similar buildings found in other places, he concluded that they were storehouses or barracks, that the holes had nothing to do with hitching posts. Had to do with the structure of the support for the upper part of the building. So I think that's one illustration of why you have to be careful in interpretation of archaeological data. In another article, Pritchard says, do I have that on your sheet? Let's see. Yeah, the second article there by Pritchard, Culture and History in the Bible and Modern Scholarship, page 313 to 324. On page 315 of that article, Pritchard says, rarely, if ever, do historical judgments emerge from the ground. They are usually deduced by archaeologists from observed evidence. Such tangible objects as pots, walls, floors, etc., take on meaning for history only as the context in which they are found can be controlled, identified, and related to other contexts by the excavator and his colleagues. This process of interpretation involves opinion, common sense, and logic. To remember these human variables, the components of any archaeological equation, is to guard against an unwarranted authoritarianism. In other words, what he's saying is these answers to these historical questions just don't pop up out of the ground. Archaeologists have to work with the material, and they have to make judgments. Their opinions come into play, and there's a lot of tentative conclusions that are drawn. And you have to be careful then in using those conclusions. There's another illustration of a shift in interpretation of a rather familiar finding of archaeology with respect to corroboration of biblical material. That has to do with the discovery of what has often been termed Solomon's copper mines and smelting furnaces. In the late 1930s, Nelson Gluck, G-L-U-E-C-K, Nelson Gluck, G-L-U-E-C-K, explored the area south of the Dead Sea near Ezion Geber. Ezion Geber is right on the coast there of the Gulf of Aqaba. Below the Dead Sea, right there. The northernmost point of the Gulf of Aqaba. And what he discovered there was that there were rich veins of copper and iron ore in that territory. And he found that that ore was mined during the time of Solomon and even later. And he found remains of copper molds, copper slag, all around that area by Ezion Geber. Gluck expected to find ruins there of Solomon's seaport. If you look at 1 Kings 9:26, you read King Solomon built ships at Eziongeber, which is near Elath and Edom on the shore of the Red Sea. And Hiram sent his men, sailors who knew the sea, to serve in the fleet with Solomon. And he was looking for some kind of evidence of the navy that Solomon had established there at Eziongeber. He didn't find that. But he did find what he thought was a smelting furnace or a refinery. I see my time's about up. I'll have to continue this in the next hour. I think, you know, even though he didn't find evidence of the seaport there, it's reasonable to conclude that Solomon was involved in copper smelting, and that perhaps he was using the copper smelting in his trade for bringing other things back and then taking them across the desert up to Jerusalem. But we'll get into some of that later. But what he thought was the smelting furnace, it seems, has turned out to have been something else as well. It's reinterpretation of evidence. But we'll look at more details of that tomorrow. Okay.